Welcome to Crescent City Crime, dear listeners. I'm Tracy.
And I'm Brian.
Welcome to everybody who is either new, and if you are returning, then welcome back.
Welcome back. Thank you for listening.
Make sure that you rate and review us on your preferred podcasting platform. Make sure that you are subscribed to us. We are everywhere. We are also on YouTube. Everything will be linked in the show notes as usual. But most importantly, tell your friends and
tell your enemies, especially your enemies.
So, Brian, you know, throughout the course of doing research for this podcast, I'm always on the lookout for things that are unusual because, you know, there's a lot of men who kill women, men who kill other men, but you don't often find women who kill. It is a more of a rarity for a woman to kill than it is for a man.
I think one of the big reasons is that, you know, most women have a maternal instinct. Whereas, you know, women are seen to be genetically built to care about others and nurture.
Well,
nurture others.
Well, it's also deep social conditioning.
Yeah.
Deep social conditioning. But today's story, we are going to talk about a woman killer. And, you know, the other thing that I'm always on the lookout for is things, because, so, for those who don't know, I'm not officially from New Orleans. I am from outside of New Orleans. I grew up in the suburbs, where not a whole lot has happened. I grew up in a very boring town.
Yeah, yeah, one of those boring, I guess you could say all-American type of rural towns. It's got, you know, they have a refinery. You could say they have a military base, too, with Jackson Barracks, you know, Army National Guard.
Yes, this is all, you know, yeah.
And it's, you know, it leans towards, you know, of course, it leans heavily towards the right, you know, Christian values, that type of thing.
Actually, it's kind of, the needle has slightly moved in recent years because we will get into a discussion about this at a different time. But, you know, in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, when there was the lawsuits about who could actually essentially move into the area. Remember that? You remember all that?
Yeah, I remember that. St. Bernard going out of its way to keep minorities from moving into the area, yeah.
Which, the, you know, the wrong side lost that lawsuit, so as a result, it is a little bit more diverse these days.
Yeah, it is.
It took a long time, though. But this is the stage I'm kind of setting for today's story. In this nice, quiet little town where nothing ever really happened until something did happen.
Now, by town, do you mean Chalmette, or do you mean Miro, or...
No, I mean Araby, which is
Araby, yes.
Close enough to where I grew up. It's the next town over, next little boat.
Araby, Louisiana, part of St. Bernard Parish. Mm-hmm. Araby intersects with the New Orleans Lower Ninth Ward.
Yes, it does. You have to go through Araby to get into the rest of the parish. That's very true.
Yeah. Is when I was, years ago I spent a lot of time in Araby because that was the location of St. Bernard Indoor Shooting Center and Indoor Shooting Range, mm-hmm. Which now it's reopened as Neutral Ground Gun Company. Mm. Different management, different owners, including the proprietor of the firearms blog from YouTube, who is part ownership in Neutral Ground Gun Company.
And we are not sponsored by any of this.
No, we're not. But, and early on, as a side note, early on, St. Bernard's Shooting Center, unfortunately, was one of the gathering places of certain bigoted white people from the St. Bernard area, who, I'm going to go ahead and bring it out in the show. Got rather angry at me when I brought my Marine Corps recruiter, Staff Sergeant Newell, who is a black bodybuilder who's in the Marine Corps. Okay, yes, he did, you know, bodybuilding competitions, okay? And he was in the shooting, okay? And, you know, all I did was bring him to a shooting competition one Sunday morning. And it wasn't lost on me the looks they were giving him, you know? Never mind the fact that he's a United States Marine. He'd already been overseas, you know, serving our country, making sacrifices, doing that, you know, while being stationed overseas, of course, as all members of the military make great sacrifices just by, you know, being overseas when they could be over here having a good time, okay, like everybody else. You know, they didn't care about that. They seemed to be outraged that I brought a black man into St. Bernard Indoor Shooting Center. And
how dare you?
Yeah, and they found a way to ban me for a period of time from their shooting matches, and they came up with a whole slew of excuses. You know, after the shooting match was over, I was showing off a replica of the Russian Takarov pistol. You know, safely handling it and everything, and someone lied and said that I drew a pistol during the shooting match. Defined it as that. It was to get me banned from the matches for a period of time, which was okay for the reason, and plus I was going off to serve our country in the Marine Corps just like Staff Sergeant Newell, you know.
That's still a bunch of malarkey.
It really freaking was. And of note, every one of these bigots who was very uncomfortable with me bringing a black man to St. Bernard Shooting Center, none of them were veterans. I wonder why. You know, cowardice and bigotry seem to go hand in hand. You know?
Of course.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Okay. One of them valiantly served in the Air National Guard during the Vietnam War. Wow. Okay. I need not say any more about that one. Okay. So anyway, just coming forward, I went to the grand opening of Neutral Ground Company, and I was pleasantly surprised to see a very diverse group of people at that range, okay, including a female same-sex couple holding hands while waiting in line to get a shooting lane.
Well, see, the Second Amendment is for everybody.
That's right! For everybody to enjoy, no matter who you are, as long as you are a lawful citizen who wishes to harm no one. Recreational use of the Second Amendment and lawful self-defense with the Second Amendment is for absolutely everybody.
Now, today's story has nothing to do with guns or race, for that matter. But it does have to do with a deadly woman. And I'm going to tell you the story right now.
A femme fatale.
Of sorts, or yeah. A black widow, if you want to call it that, too.
Yeah.
So, Ann Gibson was born in 1949. She grew up in Louisville, Indiana as an only child, and she maintained a close bond with her parents throughout her life. Her childhood friend, Tim Conwell, described her as someone who often got away with things. Now, doesn't that sound ominous? After she completed high school, she pursued a nursing career. And in 1977, she married David Plue, who was a Vietnam War veteran, and he worked at a Chrysler automobile factory. The marriage was short-lived. Less than a year after they said their vows, on May the 28th, 1978, tragedy struck when David's lifeless body was discovered on a rural road in Indiana. There were 2 gunshot wounds to the back of his head, and the murder weapon was never found. However, investigators learned that Ann's friend, Tim Conwell, had reported the theft of a .38 caliber revolver from his vehicle prior to the murder. So this is a spider web that is connecting Tim and Ann and the murder of David.
Yeah. So, but now what was the distance between, I mean, the passage of time between reporting the firearm stolen And the use of it in the crime?
I could not find that information. But if it's a small town in Indiana, I can't imagine there's very many stolen guns.
Yeah, and it seems to be a common mistake with some murderers to report a personally owned firearm stolen before it's used in the same murder.
So okay.
It's linked to you right. already. I mean, it's like that's you know, it's kind of in the criminals are stupid category. It's just so dumb to report your own firearm stolen that can be traced to you, and then you or someone you know use it in a murder.
Well, even though the specter of doubt was raised, Tim was considered a person of interest. No charges were ever brought against him. No witnesses came forward, and the case turned cold. Through his job, David had a $100,000 life insurance policy that Anne inherited. Oh.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, and she apparently thinks that's a lot of money to kill someone for. Yeah.
Well, she was able to take this money, and she got out of town very quickly. She bought a house in Picayune, Mississippi, and she moved her parents out there as well. So she had all this money. She moved her parents out to Mississippi, bought a house.
Yeah, she probably went through the money over a short period of time.
Oh, we'll get there.
Yeah.
We'll get there.
It's like, really, that's not a lot of money to take that kind of a risk for, really. But, you know, some people think small.
That's true. You should only kill somebody if they have an insurance policy worth millions of dollars.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Definitely, yeah. Kill for millions. Millions!
Who wants to be a killionaire?
Or kill for restaurant franchises like Mr. Prigozhin over there in Russia. But that we're trailing off a bit.
Yes, we are. So Picayune is about an hour away from New Orleans. This is where Anne met Raymond Gates. And it was Raymond Gates was a World War II veteran, and he was also an accountant, and he was 26 years older than Anne. They married in December of 1978, so less than a year after her beloved David got killed, she married somebody else.
Wow.
Wow.
She got over him really quickly. Wow. Quite a rebound that one is.
Isn't it, though? Yeah. And Raymond...
So, another red flag, of course.
A very big yes. red flag. Raymond had a house built for them in Araby, Louisiana. Isn't that nice? She bought a house in Picayune, and then her new husband builds them a house. Isn't that just a nice little life she's carving out for herself here?
Yeah, and some of the white flight people who left Araby went to Picayune, Mississippi.
Well, that's funny.
Yeah. Yeah, I've... Through travels through Slidell and Southern Mississippi, I run into a handful of ultra-right-wing bigots who thought it was okay to tell me certain things just because I'm white and at the time I had a short haircut.
Okay. All
right. Although it had more to do with the Marine Corps.
All right. Okay. Anne and Raymond, this marriage actually lasted for a little while. This marriage lasted for about 9 years until the night of October 7th, 1987. Anne made a frantic 911 call claiming to have found Raymond's lifeless body inside their home. He had severe head wounds. And there was a missing fireplace poker from the house, which became the potential murder weapon. After the war, Raymond had become an accountant, and he worked at Tidewater Inc., which was a small shipping company that grew into a global business. Anne was drawn to Raymond's calm disposition and gentlemanly manners. And everything seemed pretty good, like, on the surface. Like, people... thought that they had a good marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nice house in the suburbs. She had a career. He was a veteran. I mean, you know, sounds pretty nice, right?
Yeah, many a World War II veteran came back home and made a nice life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, unfortunately, Raymond's life, it did end that night. When the officers walked into the house, the TV was blaring full force, and Raymond was lying on the floor and there was blood everywhere. There were no signs of forced entry, and investigators determined that Raymond had actually been dead for several days. And they determined this because, I don't know who in our audience will remember what a TV guide was, but back in the day, we had this little magazine delivered to our house that told us what was on TV at what time and what channel.
It even had reviews here and there.
Reviews here and there.
And I believe there's a crossword puzzle in the back.
Yeah, and yeah. I think there was like a little joke section too, and
interviews.
Yeah, I mean,
they were fun, and it was the size of it was interesting.
It was small.
Yeah, it's meant to be handheld and handy, compact.
Right.
Just take with you throughout the house. Not take up a lot of space. At one point, my family, of course, this is elementary school, had a subscription to the TV Guide.
Mm.
Then when the Times-Picayune started coming out with TV listings in the Lanny app, then my family stopped subscribing to the TV Guide.
That's old school right there.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So, but the TV Guide in this case was opened to the night of October 3rd, and there was blood spatter on that page. So he had possibly been there for, what, 3 or 4 days?
Wow.
Yeah. Mm. Anne said that.
So do you think he caught the show that he looked up?
I don't know.
You know, because I mean, back then, you really did need something in print to let you know when a TV show was scheduled.
That's quite
pretty
true.
Pretty much, you know, with the exception of like hearing it announced while you're watching television, but the, you know, a TV guide was a very reliable source of that information.
So, Anne had said that she had not been at the house since September 30th. But one detail that she shared with investigators immediately aroused suspicion. She said that the man that was with her at that moment in time was her boyfriend.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. She claimed that she had an open relationship with Raymond, and that they were both having relationships on the side. She explained that she lived a couple of days a week with Raymond and a couple of days a week with her boyfriend. And she lived a couple of days a week with her parents in Picayune, Mississippi. So she's like going all over the place, staying with different people.
I mean, this kind of stuff does happen, but when there's a murder connected to it, it becomes highly suspicious, and it just reeks of a cover story.
Mm-hmm. Anne also claimed that Raymond was not bothered by this arrangement, and
sure he wasn't. Maybe they should have asked him. Oh, that's right. Well, he's dead, right?
Yes, Raymond did die.
That's
yes.
Right, yeah. How convenient.
She said that while staying with her boyfriend, Raymond had told her that he would be out of town for a few days, and that was the last time that she had spoken to him. When investigators interviewed Anne's boyfriend, he said that he was working on October the 3rd, and he did not own a car, so it would not have been... He could not have, like, just left work, gone to this house in a car, killed Raymond, and then, you know, gone back to work, you know, like on his lunch break or something. That was not a possibility. However, investigators also learned that Raymond had a life insurance policy, and it was worth $82,000. And, of course, Anne was the beneficiary of this policy. Well, you know what they say, once is happenstance, twice is pattern, right?
Yeah, and some people, I guess some people would just kill for that kind of money, you know?
So police felt like that they now had a motive, but what they did not, what they were still waiting on was an eyewitness, somebody that could place another person in the house the day of the crime. And they did soon get the evidence that they needed. The mailman had come forward, and he informed the investigators that he had seen Ann Gates's Cadillac in the driveway on October the 3rd, 1987. So she was at the house that day.
Oh, interesting.
So Ann was arrested for the murder of Raymond Gates. One of Raymond's friends also told investigators about the suspicious circumstances behind David Plew's murder 9 years earlier. By speaking to the police in Indiana, detectives learned that it was still an open murder investigation. At the time of David's murder, Ann was actually recovering in the hospital from an elective surgery. So she did have a solid alibi, but Indiana law enforcement still believed that she was somehow involved. As part of her plea deal, Ann agreed to provide a statement to authorities about the murder of Raymond Gates. In it, she laid sole responsibility for her husband's death at the feet of her longtime friend, Tim Conwell.
How typical.
Mm-hmm. She says that she picked up Tim Conwell from the airport on the morning of October the 3rd, 1987, and they were staying together at a hotel nearby. Ann said they later went to her and Raymond's home in Araby, where they watched a football game together. Ann said that while she was in the shower, she heard Raymond and Tim arguing, and when she came out of the shower, she saw Tim hitting Raymond over the head with the fireplace poker. And by the time she got to him, he had hit Raymond 7 or 8 times in the head. This is what she told police. She claimed that Raymond had his hands up in a defensive mode, and he was saying to Ann, "I've always been good to you. Why are you doing this to me?" Which, why would you tell that to your wife? If somebody else is beating you, why are you telling this to your wife? Why are you doing this to me?
And then, of course, well, the first question in my mind was, she witnessed this. Why is she still alive?
Yeah, that too.
If she's so innocent in this.
If she's so innocent in this, why is she still alive? That's a darn good question. Anne said that she helped dispose of the evidence by throwing the murder weapon into a body of water. She said that Tim Conwell then left New Orleans and warned her not to go to the police.
No, she was not coerced into helping to dispose of the evidence. And if she was so innocent in this, she of course would have been part of the evidence. She would have been murdered as well. No.
Well, an arrest warrant for Tim Conwell was secured, and he was lured to New Orleans on the premise of testifying on Ann's behalf. Instead, he was arrested, and he was charged with second-degree murder. Although he was offered a plea deal, Tim Conwell decided to go to trial. The prosecution had little evidence against him besides Ann's testimony. After a 2-day trial, the jury was unable to reach a decision. Tim Conwell was set free and he returned home to Indiana, and the prosecution decided not to retry him. Ultimately, investigators concluded that Ann was likely the one that had killed Raymond. As a result of this, Ann Gates pled no contest to manslaughter charges in Raymond's murder case, and she did this to avoid a more severe charge. despite her conviction, she successfully sued for her share of Raymond's life insurance policy.
Yes. Talk about blood money.
She's all about the money. But out of that $82,000, she only received $25,000. The rest of it did go to his surviving family members. Who, by the way, they were very taken aback and very saddened by the loss of Raymond. They also said that immediately after his death, Anne tried to distance herself from everything. She did not get involved with any funeral arrangements. She didn't console any family members or nothing.
That's very interesting. That is some pretty cagey defensive behavior right there. Yeah.
Yes.
That's that. That's, yeah, very suspicious to say the least.
She did not serve... She only served about, I think, about 8 years for this. Okay, so she didn't even serve a long sentence. She was released from prison, and wouldn't you guess it, Brian? Who do you think she wound up getting married to?
the one who the one who helped her murder her husband.
Yes, she married that guy. She married him.
Oh, boy.
In 1997. She died from kidney failure in 2016. Now.
Oh, well, that what a pity that was.
Well, as a final note to the story, though, her dark past and the lingering questions surrounding the deaths of her two husbands, you know, I mean, they continue to intrigue investigators, and they do believe that, yes, she did have David killed, even though that there was no evidence that could officially say anything. Like, they couldn't prove it in court, right? But they do believe that, yes, indeed, she was the one.
Well, as you've pointed out to me before, women are much better at planning and getting away with murders than men are typically.
Typically, yes. You know, of course, so that's a whole wide discussion of who can get away with murder better than the other.
Yes. You break it down by sex, and it's women, yeah.
Well, also, like, when you think about highly organized serial killers who have managed to do those activities for a number of years without getting caught, I don't want to say, oh, that's such a good thing that they could never get caught, but I find it very interesting how well some people are able to cover their tracks.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. You know, especially today, you know, it feels like it's more difficult to get away with things. But not always, you know. I mean, where, you know, like, there are instances where you could still get away with it, even today, even when you have a cell phone that can track your movements and you have surveillance cameras everywhere, you know, Ring doorbells and businesses that have expensive camera equipment outside of that can record everything.
Tracking someone's cell phone.
Yeah, that's what I said, tracking someone's cell phone, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that's... I mean, they're many criminals who are not only dumb enough to bring their cell phones when they go to where they're committing the crime, but even there's even the ones who post videos on, you know,
social media,
on one social media or another, especially TikTok, boasting about what they're doing, what they're getting away with, and displaying their firearms that they are just so proud of, despite the fact that they're typically not very skilled with these firearms.
Well, I was talking more about people who are getting away with it, not so much people who don't get away with it.
Right.
Although, yes, look, there's plenty of, you know, mistakes that criminals make, and that is why they get caught.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, but it is also, it's not always as easy to get to get enough evidence to bring a murder suspect to court. It's not as easy as you might think it is.
No, it's not a preponderance of evidence like it is in civil court.
Right.
It's beyond the shadow of a doubt. And it's very risky for a prosecutor to bring someone to trial on shaky evidence. And, you know, it's immaterial whether or not you can indict someone for a crime because, of course, indictment does not require even require the level of preponderance of evidence. I mean, the saying is you can indict a ham sandwich. The defense attorney's not there. And the prosecutor, you know, spins the crime in you know, with a sales pitch about guilt. And so suspicion, just mere suspicion can get an indictment, essentially. But bringing someone to trial, that's a different story, of course.
And then, of course, if you even make it to trial, you have to prove your case.
Yes.
You have to prove your case, and I'm going to tell you this. I mean, there's at least two very infamous cases that I remember in my lifetime where it looked like the person on trial should have been convicted, but they were not.
Yes.
Okay, like the two that always spring to my mind in this kind of discussion is O.J. Simpson and Casey Anthony. You know, O.J. Simpson, it really looked like it was him. I do believe in my heart that it was him. Now, why he was not convicted, we don't really know. We don't really know what the jury thought that they believed or didn't believe or whatever it was. And of course, Brian and I, we've talked about Casey Anthony a few times before, and you've said to me that the reason why you think she was not convicted was because they tried to do was it first degree murder, but really they couldn't.
They overcharged her.
They overcharged her, right?
Yes.
So, like, you just remember that first degree murder and second degree murder are different. Okay, first degree murder means that you planned it. Okay, second degree murder means that it was a heat of passion or it was accidental. Something more in that vein. Like, you know, you come home, you find your husband in bed with another woman, you shoot them both. That's manslaughter. Okay? So, you know, that's probably why, unfortunately, why Casey Anthony is not in jail, is because the prosecution wanted to go for a higher charge rather than a charge that could be proven more easily.
Yes, I mean, as per jury instructions, okay, which you will hear extensively if you ever sit in the jury. You know, I've never sat in the jury. I just played a juror on television.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, episode one of BJ Novak's The Premise. I'm the jury wearing the green shirt.
Please sponsor us, BJ Novak.
Yeah, a side note. I mean, it was like a dream come true getting the work of BJ Novak, getting instructions from him at times. And
did he instruct the jury?
That's funny. He did. Him and a couple of his assistant directors from time to time were instructing the jury.
Right.
You know, because they had to get reactions out of us. And my reactions actually got featured more than most of the other jurors because I took them seriously. I gave the directors what they wanted. But, you know, side discussion.
Yeah. So, you know, again, you always have to have to me, the evidence has to match the charge, or the charge has to match the evidence, however you want to phrase that one.
Yes, the jury is instructed on the criteria that must be met to get, you know, for the conviction, right? Based on the charge, based on what they're charged with.
Exactly.
Then this may be a wild example, okay, but let's say you have a member of organized crime who's being tried for murder, and even if even if it's discovered that he was, let's say, this, yeah, it's a state case, okay, and it's like the prosecutors discover evidence that he was, you know, of tax evasion, okay. The prosecutor can't ask the jury to convict the defendant of tax evasion.
Right.
That would be a separate prosecution, although likely if a district attorney did discover evidence of this, it would probably be forward to the U.S. attorney if it's, you know, if it's federal tax evasion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It'd be a separate trial, you know.
Right. Yeah, so...
Just like, now, I do believe if it's up to a district attorney to retry someone if they were overcharged, right, on a lesser charge.
Yes, but...
Although they may not. They're not likely to.
They may not, especially if, you know, again, let's go back to Casey Anthony, right? You know, that was a very high-profile case. The prosecutors must have been highly embarrassed when they lost that one.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It nationally televised and everything.
It could also result in the loss of a reputation for your work. It mm-hmm. could result, perhaps, in the loss of your job. You know, if a prosecutor, if a district attorney is it an elected position in every place, or is that just here?
I'm pretty sure district attorney is an elected position everywhere.
Okay, so it is possible then that a prosecutor, if they lose a high-profile case, they could not be voted back in.
You know, you're talking about district attorney, though.
Yes, but the right. district attorney...
In some jurisdictions, it's going to be one of the... It might be one of the same.
Right, but a district attorney is the one who decides what charges to bring. Right?
Possibly. I mean...
That is the prosecution's office.
District attorneys, you know, working below the proverbial district attorney, the district attorney, sometimes make those decisions themselves. It depends on how high profile cases, the district attorney, him or herself, are probably going to make that this final decision.
Right. So there is a possibility that you could lose your position. Either you're not reelected. Right. Or your boss, the district attorney, asks you to leave if you lose a high profile case. All these things are possibilities.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. The title of a district attorney who works for the district attorney is called ADA, Assistant District Attorney.
That's right. And right. I should know that because, you know, I just had a little Law and Order marathon last night, and I really should be more up on that because, yeah, everybody knows how much that show revolves around the district attorney's office and the ADA, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I've known a handful of ADAs through the years. Mm. And they, you know, after a while, they tend to become defense attorneys eventually.
Right.
You know, with the experience they get.
That's also where the money is.
Yeah, in Orleans Parish, I know they're commissioned.
Mm-hmm.
Like this particular one I used to know, Glenn Woods, you know, with his commission, he carried a Smith & Wesson 357 Magnum, which he was, during the Antoinette Franks trial, he was carrying it with him everywhere since he was threatened.
Yeah, that's something else, too. A lot of these people who do their best to work within our system to preserve justice, it's not an easy life.
No. Many of there are prosecutors who have to keep looking over their shoulders.
Prosecutors, probably even judges.
Yeah, everywhere they go, because they know that they have put some very sociopathic, narcissistic individuals in jail who take it very personally and would very much like to get revenge. Because, of course, you know, the way the mind of this kind of person works, the whole world revolves around them, the whole world's dedicated to them, and how dare anyone put them in jail regardless of anything they've done wrong. In their mind, they haven't done anything wrong.
Yes, you know. Yeah. Well, we it seems like we talk about that just about every week, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But of course, I mean, we are a true crime podcast, even though today our discussion has taken many different paths.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the mind of the type of individual we just spoke of, they have a tremendous sense of entitlement, which is coupled with every single crime committed. A sense of entitlement.
A sense of entitlement. And also, in the end, not for a whole lot of money. I mean, total $125,000.
Yeah, most of these criminals really, it seems to me like it's mostly criminals on Wall Street who are typically able to really make or break themselves financially,
right?
Based upon a financial crime, you know, essentially.
What was the name of that guy who stole all the retirement money?
You're talking about Bernie Madoff.
Bernie Madoff with all the money. Yes, him.
Yeah, he's one of the few who didn't get away with it.
Right, and also, you know, I just want to point out too that some of these, like, do you remember the Enron financial scandal and all the charges that were supposed to be bought down from that?
Yeah.
Well, the problem with that was they couldn't find enough evidence to nail the people at the top for it. So it all would have gone down to, like, one guy who was somebody who just worked under the people who told him to do these things. Like, basically his bosses told him, cook those books.
Yeah.
He did.
There were people being protected, too.
There were people being protected, yeah. But that's a reason why nobody was ultimately really convicted of anything over that, because the jury was like, well, we know it wasn't all just this one guy. You see? So sometimes, you know, justice does not happen because the people at the top are protected.
Yeah, one indication of that was the fact that President George W. Bush, in none of his addresses, spoke of Enron.
That's
after that happened.
That's very true.
And that alone was disturbing.
That alone was disturbing. Always look at the people at the top, no matter who they might be, no matter how much you might admire them. Always be suspicious of the people at the top.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it seems the president of the United States, no matter who he is not really the person on top. Is he?
Well,
I'm holding on to the discussion, okay? Yeah. Just keep in mind, someone in working government who's a chief executive who's making a six-figure salary is not going to be as powerful as some of the multi-billionaires out there.
The ones who really pull the strings.
Yeah, the ones who really pull the strings. As a side note here, you got two kinds of multi-billionaires. You got the kinds that prefer to use, people in government and just operate anonymously and keep their names. You know, some of them have controlling interests in media outlets, and they'll keep their names out of the news, okay? Like, just to name one, I won't really get into it. Mr. Maurice Strong, who is one of those multi-billionaires, okay? Mm-hmm. Big-time oil executive. Oil man, okay? So, and then you have the other type of billionaire who just loves to jump in the ring. Like Elon Musk, like Jeff Bezos, like
Mark Zuckerberg.
Like Michael Bloomberg.
Yeah, Bloomberg.
They love to just get out there, get their hands dirty in it and everything, because they, you know, they crave the power, they crave the fame and the money all at the same time.
Do you know who else is a billionaire that you don't really hear a whole lot about politically?
You thinking about Miss Gail Benson, the owner of the New Orleans Saints and a bunch of car dealerships?
No, not her, actually. No, Dick Wolf, the creator of Law and Order, is a billionaire.
Ah. Mm-hmm. Ah. You see? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But who knows where he's funneling that money to?
So he's dun, one dun. Of those. Yeah, he's one of those quiet billionaires who's pretty much a good citizen.
I think so. Like, I haven't heard anything bad about them. Well, and eventually bad things do trickle out about these people.
Yeah, like Miss Gail Benson is a very classy citizen. She's actually in the top 500 in the world. Billionaires, believe it or not, along with other NFL owners. But just an example of how classy and how much of a philanthropist Gail Benson is, besides other things, you know, involving hospitals, okay? Like, she walked into, with her assistant, she walked into the Walmart on Shopatulis downtown, I think it was the year before last, and just paid off, in December, and paid off everybody's layaways.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Wow.
She didn't even publicize it. Other people did that.
Mm.
No, she didn't make any announcement or anything like that. She didn't call a press conference. She didn't directly talk to any media about it. She just walked in there and did it, and word of mouth, it got out there.
Well, New Orleans is a small city.
Yeah.
It is. It's a small city. We don't always think of it that way, but it is a small city, and word does get around.
Yeah.
Yes. All right, everybody. So I think that's going to wrap it up for today. Next week, we're going to go back again into our Wayback Machine. We're going to talk about another old-timey crime that involves the murder of former New Orleans police chief David Hennessy.
Oh, wait. Was that involving the Battle of Liberty Place?
I'm not going to say right now.
Okay.
I don't want to give anything away.
Yeah. Yeah, there's, let's see, from my recollection, there's at least one chief of police whose name is on the New Orleans Police Officer Memorial, you know, fallen officers in the line of duty.
When we talked about the New Orleans sniper, I remember it was wasn't that Chief Sergo who got killed? He was a chief, wasn't he? Or am I remembering wrong? No, he's a major. Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we'll get to all that next week. So until then, dear listeners, be safe, be kind. Remember that we're all human beings. Remember that fear is the path to the dark side, and don't park next to vans.
If it's dark, it's dangerous, and it does not feel safe, don't go there in the first place. Make good decisions on the street. Negotiate your own best possible outcome before you have to hire an attorney. In other words, while you're on the street, be your own attorney.
Be Saul Goodman.
Okay. Yeah, be Saul Goodman on the street. Give yourself that good advice before you actually have to call someone like Saul Goodman. And if you are talking to law enforcement in a professional capacity and you are not the witness or the victim of a crime, lawyer up. Better call Saul.